Maya Lin came into the public eye when she submitted the winning design in a national competition for the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. She was still an undergraduate at Yale University at the time. Since then, she's created sculptures, memorials, and architectural projects that try to find a middle place between individuals and the landscape. Just two of her recent projects include creating Storm King Wave Field at Storm King Art Center in Mountain Vale, New York, and designing the new Museum of the Chinese in America, which opened in June in Lower Manhattan. I'm very pleased to welcome Maya Lin to our show. Hello.
Thank you.
Can you describe Storm King Wave Field? Why Wave Field?
Why Wave Field? A lot of my artwork centers on looking at natural phenomena and maybe translating it, I sometimes say regurgitating science and technology into artworks. For Wave Field, it is I don't want to say it's a recreation, but it's sort of based on a simple water wave or how a water wave forms and flows. It is the third and the last and the largest of a series. I tend to, in art, often work in sort of 2 to 3 part series. And with this one, it started with an exploration that started in 1993 with the first wave field, 100 feet by 100 feet, 10,000 square feet. The waves are based on a photographic still image of a naturally occurring water wave called a Stokes wave.
And what are they made out of?
They're made out of earth and grass. All three are earth and grass waves. A lot of times my outdoor works are based solely with the earth. And in that one, each wave was about 3 feet high, 4 feet high, human-scaled. You could sit in, curl up in a pocket of a wave and read a book. It's at a University of Michigan campus, the North Campus. The second one, I tripled the scale to 30,000 square feet. It's for a federal courthouse building, GSA, in Miami. And it is a shallow wave. It's called flutter, and it's when water moves over the sand right before it hits the land, and it's the shallow ripples. So again, very, very low waveforms, about 1 foot, 2 foot high, which I think made the security guards really happy because they're just really cautious down there, so they wanted something very low. And I wanted to end the series with something where, what if you could pull the waves up over your head? What if you could make it so that as you walk through a wave field, you actually got a little lost?
And in the way that walking through some of the Richard Serra sculptures will feel?
A little bit. And I think the waves rise up to about, I would say, 15 to 18 feet in height.
Wow.
It's 11 acres. It's a complete reclamation of a gravel pit. So we worked with the State Department of Environmental Protection on this one. I was pretty proud of that. And it changes scale drastically. So one overview is when you look down on it, you've crossed through Goldsworthy's wall, and you're just looking down, and you can see the whole thing, and it actually looks very large. And then as you go through it, it changes from being extremely intimate, where you can actually see as one wave rolls down into the next, that literally you can see and connect to the next wave. And then as a wave rises up, you lose, and you're caught between a wave.
This has always remained constant because in the Southwest, I have walked through tall grasses that had their own form of wave.
Right, and I think the waves here, and we're letting the grass grow to about a foot in length, but for the first year or two, we actually have to cut it short so that the roots take hold. And if you let it go too long, then the grass doesn't get strong enough. And since in the end we want people to walk all over this, that for the first couple years, it's be gentle on the grass. The grass root structure is still fragile. But at that point, at times there'll be a slight illusion because you'll see the grasses in the wind flowing, but then it's in a way taken over by the physical form of the waves themselves.
And how would you categorize this? Is this
earthwork?
It's earthwork.
Environmental
art. It's kind of
art.
It's kind of sculpture using earth.
Absolutely. It's definitely an earthwork. I think I have been extremely inspired by Richard Serra's work, Michael Heiser's work, Robert Smithson's work, and that there was a period in the 70s when someone like Robert Smithson walked out of the gallery and into the land. And I think that was a very formative body of work, and it's really sort of inspired me to do a lot of what I've done.
Aren't you planting trees near the wave field, not just to screen it from the New York State Thruway, but also to offset the carbon footprint of creating this
thing?
Yeah.
I'm a pretty committed environmentalist. I'm on the board of NRDC, and so we kept careful track of all the fuel that we used and the bulldozer operator used in building the piece. We ended up calculating it was about 260 tons worth of carbon, and if you can calculate that one tree in its lifetime will absorb one ton, 261 trees will probably double that amount of trees, and we'll start planting them in the fall. Part of it is this site was not used by Storm King. In fact, they hid it from view because it was an excavated gravel pit. It was a bit of an eyesore that they just hid behind a huge berm of earth. And we actually were able to build 75% of the piece with this earth berm. And then so it's facing the highway, and we'll use the trees to actually protect the view from the highway.
Well, you mentioned Robert Smithson, but I was also thinking about something a little earlier, Olmsted and Vox, when they were creating Central Park and Prospect Park.
Absolutely. And the funny thing about this piece is one of the reasons Storm King is there in the first place is in building the throughway, the whole site was sort of used for fill, and earth from the highway was deposited here. So I'm almost part of a legacy that was started at Storm King, I think 40 years ago, where the whole site was sculpted in and formed to fix what the highway building had sort of damaged.
In recent years, architecture has seemed to be more and more like sculpture. People like Frank Gehry and Zaha Hadid,
right,
and people like that. Do you see a link between this kind of thing and your architectural projects?
You know, I'm a little, I think I'm slightly different in that vein, in that I kind of separated my art from my architecture. And it's not that the aesthetics don't inform each other, but I think for me, the sculptures, I would say, are much more gestural. They're much more about the flow of the land, and there's a lot that is inspired from what you would call more gestural, expressionistic shapes. In some ways, part of my architecture is a little bit more inspired by, one could say, the Japanese aesthetic, where the architecture forms the frame in which you view the land. And there's different ways, both in that sense are very much, I would say, attuned to the environment, but in very, very different ways.
So since they come out of different aesthetics, do you like to keep your art projects separate from your architectural work, or can you work on them simultaneously?
I can work on them simultaneously. In fact, I'm sort of juggling throughout the course of a day, or one could argue, I'm sure my staff thinks I'm oddly juggling, because I'll stop mid-sentence and think about another project. And I think it's a very careful balance, and I think what I love both. They're very, very different. They tap into very, very different parts of my creative process. And one I would say is much more methodological, in that I always say it's making architecture is like writing a novel, making art is like writing a poem. And so one is more like, with a poem, for me at least, it's capturing in an instant what the gesture is. And you almost can't rework it. It's a very clear, simple thought. And in writing a novel, it's like crossing your T's, dotting your I's. You actually have to make sure sentence to sentence. And then, yes, there's a poetic whole to it, but there's a lot of building blocks that go into, so down to the doorknobs, down to the light fixtures, everything. And I don't take on that much architecture. So it gives me the time to kind of balance between the art and the architecture.
My guest is Maya Lin, who is an artist and an architect. We're talking about a number of her projects. Well, let's talk about an architectural project. Can you tell us about your design for the Museum of Chinese in America?
Yeah, MoCA.
It's of Chinese, not of the Chinese.
No, it's Museum of Chinese in America, which one could argue is syntactically a little incorrect, but in the Chinese language, it is acceptable and you can say it that way. But in American, in English, it would be Museum of the Chinese. And at this point in time, they've chosen to keep it correct in the Chinese way, knowing full well that there's this slight grammatical ambiguity. Because in a sense, in English, it would be Museum of Chinese as in the language. So it goes back and forth. But I am...
Is this a ground-up building?
It is not. It's an 1890s renovation of 12th 14,000 square feet, ground floor and lower level. It's on Center Street, 211 Center Street. It has two street fronts and a double width building. So it's two buildings that have been put together that have a interior skylit courtyard. And I've kind of framed the entire architectural core exhibit around this courtyard, and I've left it deliberately very old, very raw, and it's almost like the past. To me, it reminds me a little bit of a Chinese courtyard house, and the past is always pulling you a little bit, or there are hints of it.
Well, the problem here, I guess, the goal here is to somehow find a way to maintain the integrity of the building that you're working within without being controlled by it.
Right, and I also think that very rarely in architecture, because again, I have worked on pieces that are history works, the memorials, whether it's civil rights, Vietnam, women's rights, Native American rights. In architecture, you don't get generally as much of a prescribed function or goal that is a very symbolic one that can be so historically loaded. With a history museum, Chinese American, a history museum, could I incorporate time as part of the architectural design? And so that's why they're consciously very new spaces. The entryway, the entrance to the museum and lobby on Center Street, the Lafayette Street side, which will be open as much at nighttime, because as much about MoCA is the permanent exhibition, there are temporary galleries which will always be rotating out. There's right now for the summer programming, they've got a Chinatown Film Festival where they invited 10 filmmakers to come in and do short films about Chinatown. So there'll be as much of an engagement from the Lafayette Street side, and those areas are very contemporary, as is the temporary gallery space. But then the permanent core exhibition, it's all about the relationship between the old building left pretty raw and then how core gallery rotates around it, and it's this ambiguity. Is it old? Is it new? And so there is within the architecture itself, I've been able to imbue it with a little bit of what normally I might have to focus on more in my memorial works, time and history, mixing with content.
But you have a journey wall, which kind of allows you to do that.
Absolutely. There is at the front. Again, there have been some really strong exhibition designers, management and matter, who are responsible for the core exhibition, but we've all been working together so that around the front entrance, as an artist, I couldn't resist. So I created something called a journey wall. Part of it is because I am from Ohio, and when people would say, "Where are you from?" I'd say, "Ohio," and they'd say, "No, where are you really from?" And it's that really, what does that really mean? Am I not allowed to be from America?
Well, they don't ask other people. They don't ask me, where are you from? Are you from Eastern Europe? Are you from Western Europe?
Right. And I think inherently in that question, what they might say innocently, it leaves the question of, do we belong here? Do we fit in? So the journey wall actually allows smaller donors to donate monies and dedicate a tile to their family, naming where they came from in China, where they ended up in the United States.
But I assume this does have certain personal significance for you because it is the first project that you've worked on that is Chinese-related.
Well, actually, it is and it isn't. I was working with the co-founder, Jack Chen, on a space that no longer belongs to the Asian Pacific America Center at NYU. I did a small renovation of their space, and I think NYU absorbed it in at a certain point.
Do you like doing renovations as opposed to actually just having a plot of land and envisioning a building to go on
you
top
know what?
Of it?
They're really, really different, and I think it's equally challenging. I think right now there are two houses. One's under construction. One will start. They're very challenging. I think working within an urban fabric is pretty engaging, and especially working with institutions. I mean, I think part of me going through architecture school, I always realized that this is a profession that, in a funny way, if we're not careful, it's high budgets for clients that can afford it. And part of me, maybe it's because my parents are both educators from Ohio, I think I've always chosen that one of my architectural projects in will be for a not-for-profit, and they're actually for very, very tight budgets. And I think there's a great challenge in that, and I think that it's really important that we kind of bring design into a level where it's not always for the really high-end budgets. And I think urban infill, again, being environmentalist, really important. This is going to be a Silver LEEDs rated building, and again, I'm really committed to that.
Well, there's also an aspect of ego in doing a building from scratch, and
yes.
Those are the buildings that architects tend to show when they're showing off for clients. I did this. This is mine. But and you as a sculptor should understand that.
I do. I mean, I think for me, because I'm sort of pursuing both the art, the architecture, and the memorials, I have to take it all with a certain bit of pacing, and I feel very much that I'm definitely committed to the architecture, but again, I'll take it slowly, because again, I have to be very careful in order to make the art that I don't take on too much work as an architect. And so right now, like, I'm about to take a sabbatical for a year. So for the last 3 years, I've had to slow my studio down. And MoCA was the only architecture project I let in. And so again, I think it's more because I believed in the project and I believed in the group. And now I'm on the board. And I would say probably two-thirds of my time is spent as a board member more than as an architect. So I got a little carried away with this one. But again, I've not been able to really explore my heritage and my roots. And MoCA has really opened up a dialogue. And so I've been pretty interested about being more a part of MoCA.
Well, you're an architect, an artist, a board member, and also you've described yourself as a committed environmentalist. And we'll come back to all of that after we take a little break. My guest is Maya Lin. My guest is Maya Lin, an artist and an architect, the recipient of numerous prizes and awards, including the Presidential Design Award, a National Endowment for the Arts Artist Award, the William A. Bernoulli Resident in Architecture Fellowship at the American Academy in Rome, the Award in Architecture from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and honorary doctorates from Yale, Harvard, Williams, and Smith College, among others. Serves on the boards of trustees for various organizations, and in her spare time, she seems to be designing buildings and making art and working at places like Storm King. You said you're taking a sabbatical. That's because you starting to feel a little overwhelmed?
I made a promise to my husband about 10 years ago when I think he realized he had married a workaholic that I'd take a year off when a certain birthday came around. So the year is upon us. We have two kids, two girls, 12 years old almost and 10, and we're taking them out of school. We've got a teacher, and I think we're going to sort of take time out and sort of step back a little bit.
I mentioned earlier you've described yourself as being a committed environmentalist. Do you design buildings with environmental sustainability in mind?
Yeah, I think for the last 20 years, it started with incorporating recycled, reclaimed materials, passive daylighting. I did Aveda's headquarters downtown. I've always been very, very interested. Urban infill. The Grayston Bakery was done as a brownfield remediation site where I actually think all the baking equipment, all the energy was recycled into the building. So I've always tried to incorporate a lot about the energy efficiency and within the building materials. But I also believe it's more the psychology of how you relate to the landscape. So most of these designs have an ambiguity of being about indoor to outdoor. There isn't a cut and dried, this is the inside and I'm a contained space. I've always created these buildings that have outdoor rooms that are, again, getting you to connect back and, again, framing views out to the land where you feel very much a part of the land.
Is this because of the special situation of your education? You have a degree in architecture from Yale, but if I remember the architecture department in Yale and the Paul Rudolph building, it was in the same building as the art department. And I suspect that all you have to do is walk up or down the stairs to engage in one or the other activity.
Well, actually, I think it started even before then. My dad was a ceramicist, a professor of ceramics at Ohio University. He was also dean of fine arts. So I was a very bookish student. I loved the environment. I think I grew up at the time when the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, Lake Erie was catching on fire. The images that were probably most changing for me were the fact that DDT could have caused such damage to the raptor populations, and that for the first time, I think there was a growing awareness that we were, as a species, doing so much damage to the environment. So I was out there boycotting. I was out there getting petitions for stopping the whale hunting, and I remember being out in the parking lot trying to abolish steel traps, because this is sort of a rural part of Ohio, southeastern. And I was also making art all the time. So I was casting bronzes by the time I was in high school. And there wasn't much for me to do, so I was either studying or making art. And I got to Yale, and I was all ready to go into field zoology and animal behavior. In fact, my advisor my freshman year was a science advisor, and I'll never forget, he was wonderful, Robert Apfel. He's since passed away. And he said, well, you know, you might not like Yale's animal behavior program because it's neurologically based. And he sort of explained what that meant, and I said, you're right, I'm not. So at that point, I'm kind of a bit of a nerd, and I thought, I have to decide. What am I going to decide? And I chose architecture because it seemed to be a balance between art and math, which I love. I love science. I love math. And what I've found is that I've been able to get back to science through my art. And so I'll probably spend a lot of time just talking to different groups like Woods Hole and looking up what I can with satellite views of the Earth and sonar resonancing maps. So I've been able to kind of not abandon what my interests are in the environment.
But many of your pieces also have political implications. I'm thinking of the Civil Rights Memorial for the Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery, Alabama, your women's table at Yale University. Is it important to you that you agree politically when you're offered a commission?
Yes, absolutely. I think you know, you get started with the Vietnam Memorial, and I was very, very conscious of not getting typecast for doing memorials. But
and I'm sure that you were offered memorial after that.
And I think the reality is, when the Southern Poverty Law Center asked, I couldn't believe there wasn't a national memorial to civil rights. And I realized I was reading about the history that hadn't been taught to me when I was going to school, and that I didn't realize growing up that there was a kid who was killed for using the wrong bathroom. And I said, if I don't know it, if this history is being lost, then how are we going to learn from it? So I took on the Civil Rights Memorial knowing that it probably was going to typecast me a certain way, and I'd be fighting extra hard to, in a way, establish myself later in art or architecture. But I felt compelled. I think I'm drawn to probably what you would say are the formative cultural historical issues of our time. So war, civil rights, women's rights. Again, I was about to launch what would be the last of the memorials focused on endangered species, endangered habitats. And I got a call from the then governor of Washington, Gary Locke, and he said, would you please meet with these people? And the people who were trying to reach me were people who I thought were the Lewis and Clark Centennial, not centennial when it's two, bicentennial? Anyway, they kept calling, and I kept going, I'm about to start something about the environment, I can't do this. And Gary, Governor Locke, said, would you just meet with them? And when members of the Nez Perce, the Umatilla, the Chinook tribe came to my studio and said, we chose you, I couldn't say no. And so, yes, Confluence Project, it's you know, 5 years in, it'll be another three. It's very complex. I'm doing a lot of ecological restoration.
Well, I'm assuming that resisting the being typecast is the reason that you remained in school to get an architecture degree after the success of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. I'm sure people were saying, hey, we have a memorial. How about quitting school and doing this? You can always go back to school.
I was an undergrad when the Vietnam Memorial I won.
Did you even wind up designing that as an undergrad?
It was a competition. I actually did it because as a senior at Yale, you could set up your own senior seminar. And there were about seven of us, and we decided what would be a great topic. I know it's a little strange. Funereal architecture. So we, seven of us, found a professor, Andy Burr, and he agreed to be our teacher. And so it was our senior course. And we were studying the architecture of death. I know it sounds a little funny.
We're not talking funeral homes here. We're talking about memorials.
I actually think our professor was a real postmodernist, and he actually thought it was going to be about cherubs and cenotaphs and little decorations and cemeteries. And some of us were much more interested in the other issues. So the project before the Vietnam Memorial, someone saw that as a competition and said, hey, let's make that our last project. So I designed it for that and then entered it. But the project before that was design a memorial to World War III. So in typical Maya fashion, I designed something that had a very scary random entry in. You traveled down into the earth. It was terrifying. It was frightening. And you're left with nothing at the end. And then you have to turn around and go back up. So it's pretty futile. And I'll never forget, the professor was so mad at me. And he said, if I had a brother who died in that war, I would never want to go down here. And I said, Andy, it's World War III. We're not going to be here. So I had a very different take on what a memorial can be. And to me, memorials are teaching tools, and they're about looking at history and how can we learn from our past, how can we remember it accurately, and then hopefully it'll guide us to a different future.
And that's what led to both the controversy and the success of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. Part of the wall's power is that it's approachable and tactile, and people see their reflections in it. It's human scale. People touch it, make rubbings of names. Is that something that you aim for when you were designing it, or were you surprised by how people came to interact with it so much?
I think there's a personal intimacy of it, and I always say it's like reading a book in a very public place. The text is tiny. The lettering is half an inch high. No matter how many people are there, you can still have a very private experience. And I don't know if I was consciously after that, though I tend to, and since then all my work has been about that exact same thing. No matter how public, no matter how monumental, these works break down to a very singular psychological connected experience for one person. I always call them the anti-monuments, and there is something oddly subtle yet private, no matter how public they are. And I think that's something that is very much a connecting factor in all the works, whether it's art or architecture or the memorials.
Well, you're currently working, I gather, before your sabbatical, on a project called What Is Missing, which you've called your last memorial.
Yeah.
In your book, Boundaries, you wrote about your ideas for a kind of loose memorial, which you called the Extinction Project. Is this project based on that?
It is. I've been collecting data for it for about 20 years. I've always felt like I work in series that, for me, the memorials would be sort of closed with the one that I've sort of set up my own not-for-profit foundation and would call into being. So there's a commission from the San Francisco Arts Commission that enabled me. I gave them one artwork and seeded the funding for the first iteration. So what if you could make a memorial that could jump form, that could exist in many places simultaneously and also exist as a traveling exhibit, as an electronic billboard in Times Square? So Creative Time is giving me the MTV billboard at Earth Day 2010. And it'll exist on the web. There'll be a component that is three maps, a map of memory, which starts with, say, the great explorers, the great scientists, what they observed this planet used to have. So Christopher Columbus, when he sailed into the Caribbean, he thought he had run aground. He hadn't. He had run into a sea of green turtles. Or I'm right now working with an author who is an expert on Marco Polo, and Marco Polo cites unicorns, not as pretty as he thought they would be, and how abundant they were. And there are, of course, the Asian rhinoceros, which is almost extinct. And so it's seeded with notations from the past of almost things that are these wonderful images of what the planet used to be and how much we've lost. And then it'll go to a map of the present, which will link to a lot of the groups I'm working with, take us and show us what the experts are doing to help. And then it'll end with a map of the future, which will predict three plausible ways we could look, where we could balance our footprint with the needs of the planet.
And there's also an exhibit of your artwork called Maya Lin, Systematic Landscapes, at the Corcoran Gallery in Washington that will close very soon, July 12th. At Storm King, an exhibit called Maya Lin, Bodies of Water. You've been busy.
Not so busy. Systematic Landscapes. Okay, it took me 8 years to figure that show out. My first show, my first and only show before that was Topologies. And it was all about work and the landscape, but they were more object-oriented. So with Systematic Landscapes, it was literally, can I bring what I do outside inside? And so the largest pieces of that show, there are three, will be coming to my gallery, Pace, in the fall, September.
Great. And I want to thank you so much for coming by here.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Maya Lin, the artist, architect, environmentalist, designer of furniture. We didn't even get into that. And who knows what else. It's been a great pleasure having this conversation with you.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, Robin O'Brien looks at why the levels of toxins in our food supply have increased so much in recent years and how that's making people sick. Then we'll celebrate the 50th anniversary of the French New Wave in cinema, and Jim Lynch on his new novel, Border Songs, about the life of a Border Patrol agent, plus the gurus of how-to, Al and Larry Ubell, who'll answer your home repair questions. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Miranda Schaefer, Angela Sheldon, and Sherry Shan. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you tomorrow.